Hey, this is Clea Linda, and you're listening to Made of Fail.
Hello.
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 Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello.
I think I speak for everyone here when I say, huh?
Here we are now. Entertain us.
Made of Fail.
We never promised.
Miss Custodiet Ipsos Custodes?
I know that one. Who watches the watchman? Me, Mr. Pessimal.
We'll look up and shout, save us. And I'll whisper, no.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome yet again to Made of Fail. I am Kevin.
As always, still Dana.
And tonight we have Adam and Cleo back with us.
Free time return.
Yes, apparently the fan petitions just weren't strong enough.
How are you guys doing?
Excellent. Thank you for asking.
You know, it's been an interesting couple of weeks here at Made of Fail. And
can I tell a story?
We can... You know, have Dana tell a story if she wants.
It's a sad story. It's a sad story about a girl and her computer and what happens when she emanates a destroy everything technological within 100-yard radius.
I think I've seen this one.
Field thing. Oh, yeah, rerun. Okay, so we're getting ready to do the show like the 7th, I think it was. That was the Sunday after Watchmen, right? We're getting ready to do the show. And that very morning, my monitor, which had been dying for a few days, finally blows out on me. I have Kevin order me a new one, and then we find out it's not going to ship to my address at all, for any reason. You know,
oh, no,
so
there's a reason. But
well, it's the screw you, Dana clause.
Yes.
No relation to Santa. So my husband comes up with the fantastic idea of using our gigantic... you know, flat screen HDTV as a monitor, which is great, and it worked out beautifully, and the internet's huge! And then my mouse and keyboard stop working. Completely. And I'm jiggling, and I'm coming up with new curse words, and I'm re-plugging and installing, and it's not working.
I think I've seen a porno like this once.
I don't want to know what you do in your...
I know I've read a hentai dungeon like this once.
Anyway, continue,
so,
please.
So, finally, after lots and lots and lots of cursing, I asked my friend Jason, you know, hey, remember that new computer you built me? Can you ship it, like, right now? So I'm getting a new computer, which actually is going to be the first time anybody's spent that, you know, significant amount of money on Made of Fail. So, Jason. But then, before we get it shipped, Carl just up and boots the thing out of, you know, for no, I don't even know why he bothered trying, but it worked. And so now that's how we have the show for you today.
Yes.
Because we jiggled something.
Yeah, I was expecting to not do it for another week and a half, and it was like,
that's what
go
we were
time,
thinking.
Oh my god, get there, oh my god.
As usual, things have been saved by my husband jiggling something. I expect you to make
said.
A lot of money doing this.
But I think,
it's
honestly...
It's a rare talent.
Honestly, what this means, guys, everybody, dear listeners, is that the bar has been raised. There is now a minimum that you have to pay for the show.
Oh,
you must
stop.
Buy everybody a new computer.
Seems like I keep getting all the love.
Yeah, what's the deal? Why does Dana get all the perks? I'm the one who does all the work.
I have boobs.
Actually, I wasn't going to say that, but thank you, Dana. You just totally made my point for me.
Well, yeah.
No respect. No respect at all.
Well, but apparently the lack of respect for you sells, because I want to thank, before we get totally started here...
Oh, yes.
My artist friend Kara up in Canada, she's been promoting Made of Fail very heavily with some promo cards. And most of them that got given away were the ones of you and the Mudkip. So
yes.
Apparently everybody loves that one. So your lack of dignity is actually a big selling point for the show.
I sacrifice my everything for this show.
Do you see
it's
any ghosts
around?
It's
all for the art, really, with Kevin. It's he's just totally committed.
Kevin, do you see any goats around?
No.
Why?
Well, because I sacrificed them all.
Okay, can we do the show now?
Hey, look!
Yes,
we're recording.
Thanks.
I guess it's going to be like a big, grand, why stuff is awesome. Because this is like the big, grand, why Watchmen is awesome episode.
Yes.
And we've been hanging on to this forever.
Yes. This has been something that we've been looking forward to since, God, what was it, episode 2 that we mentioned that we were first listening
Whenever
to?
Whenever we found out that it was even being made a movie.
Oh, it was before we started recording, but I mean, when we first met, it doesn't matter when we first mentioned it, we've been looking forward to this for
I
a while.
I claimed my spot in, I think, November.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. You definitely did. You were going to be a
like,
part of this.
Dibs.
Adam said that he was going to mail me a kitty bomb if I didn't let him in on this one, and
so I guess we had to.
Yeah.
Fine.
Man, and I bought all those irate half-starved Mexican kittens for nothing.
That's okay. We can just give you Joe Quesada's address.
Oh, it's already en route.
Hey-o.
Hey, Cleo, what'd you think of Watchmen? On topic.
You know, that's a lot of movie. That is a lot of movie.
It really is.
I just came out of it kind of not really knowing what... I liked it. I liked it because I kept thinking of it in terms of, you know, with the book in my head.
Mm-hmm.
How could they have done it badly? And I saw all of these visions of
they could have done it really badly.
Right. And so I was like, this is so good compared to what they could have done with it. You know, I think the only thing that I just really didn't like some of the music. Like, thematically, it worked, but it was just like, it wasn't the tone I wanted to hear. Like, when they played Sound of Silence over the funeral.
Well, I've heard a lot of complaints about that.
We'll touch on this in a second. Let me just say, for those of you listeners who
spoiler warning.
No, but for those of you who have been living in a cave for the past couple years, or 20 years, Watchmen is just the comic book that redefined the superhero genre. It's a international bestseller. It's been on the Time Magazine's 100 best novels of all time, and they don't have a comics category.
They didn't have one for the Hugo Awards either, and it still won one of those.
It won a Hugo. If you have not picked this up, do so right away. It's Watchmen by Alan Moore. It was written back in the mid-80s. It takes place in an alternate 1985.
I think it was 86 that they just
that
as a note
released.
The time list was 100 books of the 20th century, so yes. It wasn't actually competing against like Shakespeare or something. It
right.
Did I say of all time? I meant
yeah.
Okay.
It should have been of all time though.
It should have been of all time.
I do think that Rorschach could take Henry V.
Oh,
just
I don't know.
Throwing that
that's one that'll go to the judges.
Okay. Before we get too deep in this, I'm just gonna. Spoiler warning, spoiler warning, spoiler warning, spoiler warning. Okay. I'm done.
I think you got a little shill on your face there, Dana. You may want to wipe that off.
Oh, man. And here I thought that... Oh, never mind. I shouldn't go there. Never mind.
Good night, everybody.
Let's plant them up ahead.
Anyway. Back to what we were saying.
The credits, the opening credits were just amazing.
Oh my god, everybody loved those. Everybody
oh,
in the theater
was
sitting there going, oh, look!
And here's the thing.
I thought the choice of music there was really appropriate. And just
they couldn't have put it to anything else.
Here is the main thing, though. I mean, of all the various reviews of the movie that has popped up on the internet, in magazines, newspapers, on TV, everything, you've got all the critics divided into two crowds. You've got people who know about the comic, like the comic, and thus absolutely loved the movie, and everybody else who were just confused.
Because
Roger Ebert is of the fanboy category, which is pretty awesome, but what every single review, all the glowing reviews, all the so-so reviews, all the this really doesn't work, every single one of them has said that the best part of the entire movie was that the opening credit sequence, which involved the entire history, all of the little side story stuff that it was at the end of each chapter, you know, Under the Hood by Hollis Mason, all of that,
well, that wasn't
was condensed.
In it.
No, but
that's
going to
be in the DVD.
No, but a lot of the story that you got only through that stuff was explained through the opening credit sequence, which started out with the Minutemen in the 40s and ended up with, you know, the obligatory, hey, this is exactly like the beginning part of it, picture in the 70s with the Crime Busters. So
did you guys see the shot in the credits of Night Owl saving Bruce Wayne's parents?
No! I'm gonna have to go back and watch it again.
I'll send you the get y'all the links for
this.
Oh,
I've got the link to the opening credits. I just never bothered to actually look again.
I never saw that.
What I liked was how what I absolutely loved was they actually gave Silhouette this some screen time, and she was only in like maybe a brief mention in Under the Hood and like one panel in the entire thing. But she was the token lesbian in the Minutemen back in the 40s, and there's this beautiful shot in the opening credits of her reenacting that, you know, kissing the sailor, you know, that the whole thing, and the nurse.
Day.
Yeah,
that was so well done.
That was hilarious. I love
as
that.
The sailor was walking up, getting ready to kiss that girl. You saw the confused look on his face as everything faded out. What I loved that there was a touch of, I mean, there was all of this in the credits, but also throughout the movie, because obviously, you can't get everything in. Everything.
Oh, no. It's just like,
but there
it's
were
just like
so
book.
Many little details that you would only pick up on if you had read the book. There was, like, in the opening credits, you see Rorschach as a kid. You wouldn't understand this if you hadn't seen the movie or read the book already. It's like, why is this the focus of a little redhead kid? And that's really awesome. There's that sign outside of Hollis Mason's auto repair shop that says, we repair your obsolete vehicles,
yeah,
which you wouldn't understand. You wouldn't even catch that if you hadn't read the book. But having read the book, you're like, and it's so unobtrusive that it doesn't matter if you had don't know what it means or not, because it's only there.
That's why I'm so glad.
Music.
No, what was the elevator music?
The elevator music in Ozymandias's office was an instrumental of Everybody Wants to Rule the World.
Yes. That was pretty glorious.
I did not notice that, but I really wish I had.
Man, I gotta go back and see it again. And again.
So we should probably have some sort of format to how we're talking about this. Otherwise, it's just gonna be, you know, 2 hours of us. Oh my god, that was so awesome. Oh my god, that was so awesome. So I would like to have a roundtable discussion of, first off,
okay,
what was your guys' favorite part of the movie? What did you think got really captured the best? What just set off your "this is awesome" alarm in your head as you were watching it? Let's start with Dana. Why, go ahead.
The very first, I mean, just the where the comedian gets thrown out the window, and you know, then they do that establishing shot of the little smiley badge in the gutter and that pan upward, and then you hear Rorschach's journal, October, whatever it was, 1985, dog carcass in alleyway. And I'm like sitting there in the theater mouthing along with the words, and I'm like, oh my God, they got all the detail. I mean, and I loved the fight scene because you actually got to see Eddie fighting back. I mean, it was implied in the comic that, you know, he wouldn't have gone down easily because he was in such good shape and everything. But I really loved how, you know, they actually showed him putting up a fight and you know, trying his best to survive. Even though, he, you know, we all know what's going to happen. He's sort of the MacGuffin, if you will, for the entire movie. I really, really love Jackie Earle Haley as Rorschach. He was probably the best performance out of the entire thing. There's so much. I can't really narrow it down. I mean, that's where it first grabbed me, was just the opening shots. But I just knew as soon as I saw it that this was going to be the best they could have possibly done with this movie and this adaptation, and just how much respect they were showing the source.
All right, Adam?
I believe my favorite part was when the police had Rorschach's Moloch's apartment and they're getting ready to bring him in. Just watching Rorschach's, just that whole scene was just amazing, I thought. Just watching one man take out an entire SWAT team and only being brought down because he was ambushed outside. I thought that was just really well done. One of the I thought it was better than the jail fight scene, personally.
And that was pretty awesome. Actually, let me touch on this for just a moment before we go back to the roundtable thing.
I had seen
Devin, our guest editor for last episode, yay Devin, had a review of the movie in his journal, and he had said that it was kind of not so plausible that everybody fought like a ninja, especially Rorschach, and I disagree with that. Everybody had a fairly distinctive fighting style that they fought the way that I would always imagine that they would have fought. Eddie Blake.
And if they couldn't fight, why were they going into superheroing in the first place?
Exactly. But Eddie Blake was an all-out brawler, just a huge powerhouse, kicking, punching for everything he was worth. Dan Dreeberg, Night Owl, basically Batman. Silk Spectre, pirouetting and balleting and breaking people's tibias. And Rorschach, Devin actually had the biggest complaint with how Rorschach fought, and I'm just sitting there saying, well, wait a minute, Rorschach was one of the best gymnasts of his high school class. Don't you think he would be incredibly flexible and work that into his fighting style?
Oh, and Ozymandias was just really precise, like he knew exactly what he was doing.
And they everything fit the characters perfectly down to that fighting style, so and that's just another one of those just tiny details that just really got. Anyway, you were saying
something about a format.
Yes, I got derailed. I was saving that for the show, and I was like, I had to get that out there. Anyway, Adam, were you finished with that?
I just wanted to add. You were talking about Eddie Blake has just all-out brawl. It's brought through that when he's fighting Ozymandias in his apartment. He actually punches through marble, if you'll notice. Mm-hmm. He actually punches the corner off of a marble mantelpiece, and I was just like, damn. How is his hand not shattered?
It probably was. I mean, he was fighting for his life, though. But no, he was fighting for his life at that point. He probably was like, okay, I gotta go all out, otherwise he's gonna kill me.
Adrenaline rush.
But that wouldn't stop his hand from shattering. But at that point, it probably did, probably didn't care.
Yeah.
So
at least it shattered the marble too. That's the important thing.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Cleo.
I think probably just one of the. I mean, this is just such a powerful moment in the movie. But it's basically when Rorschach just says, "You know, I can't let him get away with this, and if you won't let me go, then." Just kill me. I mean, I actually started looking forward to the scenes where Jackie Earle Haley would have his mask off because he was so amazing. I loved the line in the prison, you know, the chow line or whatever, when he was like, I'm not locked in here with you, you're locked in here with me. And I mean, that just, wow, the way he delivered that.
Yeah, out of
I got laughs at some theaters, though. I was like, that's not funny. That's kind of terrifying.
In my theater, he didn't get laughs from that. He got laughs at the parts that were funny. I mean, when he had all his dark sarcasm and his little quips, especially in the prison scene, but also way at the beginning. But way back in the beginning, too, why are so few of us left active, healthy, and without mental disorders?
And thank you for calling me at 3:11 in the freaking morning and leaving that on my voicemail, Kevin.
You're really normally awake at that time, okay? That was not that big of a jump for me to believe that was okay to do that, okay? So don't you be getting on my case, Miss. Oh, hey, every time you talk to me, it's always, hey, so I was up at like 6 in the morning, up until 6 in the morning last night. That's all I hear. That's all I'm going to understand.
Mm-hmm.
But what got the biggest laughs out of my theater, because I went, you know, midnight showing, opening night, the biggest laugh was that scene where Dan and Lori were in the restaurant, and they were talking about that really perverted supervillain that wasn't really a supervillain. And they're like, well, whatever happened to him? Oh, he tried it on Rorschach, and he dropped him down an elevator shaft, and everybody cheered. It was great. That was
I love how they delivered that line.
The delivery that was
a great moment of laughter at my theater as well.
The delivery was perfect.
Brilliant delivery.
And
it was just like, oh, Rorschach, you're so crazy. I'm just like, okay.
I'm nutty!
Oh, don't start. Well, since you brought it up, you might as well mention it.
Mention what, pray tell?
Saturday Morning Watchmen.
Oh, yes, that video on Newgrounds.
Even though the entire internet has seen it by now, this was going to be a little bit more timely. Thank you, computer.
Where someone put together a really great job of animation of, you know, and the classic pictures of everybody, like, what if this was a Saturday morning cartoon way back in the 80s? And it's just perfect. Everybody go check this out, Saturday Morning Watchmen.
Okay, since we're doing a roundtable, can I bring something up?
Sure.
Okay, now, this is going to probably spark off a really long discussion, but I think we should sort of get into the whole thematic elements of the movie and the book, and what point was it trying to make. And now, Adam, you're sort of a recent reader, right? Are you the one who just read it, or was that Devin?
Yes, I had just read it, I think, a couple of weeks before the movie came out. So I haven't dedicated, like, 15 or 20 years of my life to reading this book. So I kind of have a fresh perspective, I guess.
Now, see, as far as I can tell, it's a huge morality tale, Watchmen. It's sort of disguised as a superhero comic book. But it's not. It starts off with, you know, the whole point of the story is that there's this group of superheroes in alternate reality 1985. One of their own gets murdered. They investigate it, and then it sort of turns into this fantastic character study, this study of morality. It's sort of, to me, it feels like it raises the question of what is absolute morality? Is there absolute morality? Who has, you know, should anybody be allowed to decide, you know, what is and what is not good and evil and what's best for humanity? And every single character has sort of their own view on that and their own reasons for it. I mean, obviously the main one, if you look at Rorschach, it's no matter what, evil must be punished. And I mean, that's his whole thing.
And that's his whole thing through, you know, the entire thing way back in the very first chapter in one of the, at the end of the chapter in one of his early journal entries, he says, and I will not compromise on this, not even in the face of Armageddon, which is a line that he repeats during his tearful death scene, honestly, Dan turns to him and says, how about a compromise? He says, not in the face of Armageddon. And walks away.
No, not even in the face of Armageddon. Never compromise. Mm-hmm. It kind of made me upset that they kind of butchered that a little bit in the movie because it wasn't, you know, verbatim.
No, well, okay.
But did they get the
now
point
that you
across?
Brought this up? Now that you brought this up, let's go ahead and discuss the whole how much of an adaptation is a good adaptation. Should it have been line for line, scene by scene, panel by panel, or was it condensed enough, or was it not condensed enough?
As long as they got the motives for the characters right, as long as they got the moral or anti-moral message, or the ambiguity thereof, as long as they got that right, if you can just distill it down to its essence and keep it on screen, that's good enough. I think Watchmen went a step further with all the detail they put into it, which is why Dave Gibbons was a creative consultant. He was the artist on the book, and he's the one who put in a lot of those little details. A lot of that wasn't Alan Moore. A lot of that was Dave. And I think they showed great respect for the source material by using so much dialogue. And I think, honestly, there's a lot of nitpickers out there. There's a lot of people who are going to be like, they changed this, they changed that. But I think they got the spine of it right. They used as much dialogue as they possibly could. I think because Zack Snyder had such a great respect for the material. I mean, he was fighting as many cuts as he possibly could. He was like, I'm not going to compromise on this. I'm not going to compromise on that. Much like Rorschach. I mean, you know, he refused to deviate from what he saw. I mean, how could you really improve on it? And a lot of people don't think there should have been a movie in the first place. But, you know, for my money...
Alan Moore.
For my money, that was the absolute best they could have done.
Yeah. Did you see the article where Snyder talked about the movie the studio wanted him to make?
I'm afraid to click because on any of those links.
Actually,
that was totally horrifying.
I had read a I probably haven't read the exact article that you're talking about. I had read an interview where he had said that just to spite the studio who had suggested that, he put in even more junk of Manhattan than it was probably anybody would be comfortable with.
Well, Cleo, you haven't really said much, so why don't you go ahead and horrify
us. Stop interrupting me.
Usually that's my job.
Yeah. Pull up the actual article, see if I can find it. No, what he said was, what they said was, can we give it a happy ending?
Can we have
Night Owl, like, crash the owl ship on top of Ozymandias' head to kill him? You know, just to make sure that people have that closure.
Now I'm really sad that I asked you to say anything.
Yeah, I mean, there was just... That was the one thing I remember that I was like...
I know they wanted a big 9/11 allegory.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They wanted to move it into the present day.
Oh, and actually, there was that one shot where you first meet Adrian, and he's up in his towers, and you see in the background, just see, I took one novel in film class, and it ruined me. The framing of the shot where you see out his windows, he's sort of like panned left, and in the background, there's this giant-ass blimp right next to the World Trade Center, and I'm like, did they really have to put that there? Like this,
yeah,
was,
I noticed
this
that.
Airborne object. It made me really kind of squirmy. And
the fact that it was the giant purple Gunga Diner blimp.
Heading right for it. And I'm like, please don't crash into it. Please don't put that in this movie. Please don't do this. Please don't do that.
Well, they even kind of had a George Bush reference, because when they were talking about Ronald Reagan at the end, I think the line in the book was, you know, they wouldn't put an actor in the White House. And they, unless I'm imagining this, they changed
the line.
Who would put a cowboy actor in the White House? And,
they just changed it to cowboy. And oh my God, Lewis from episode 12, he really railed on that. And I think that's just nitpicking.
Well,
we know we're watching 1985. I associated cowboy with Ronald Reagan. I didn't really, you know.
It works both ways.
That's what the original joke was. Actually, the original line was Robert Redford is going to be running for president. The original joke was a joke towards Ronald Reagan, because that's what it was. So they probably thought, and this is me putting words in the producer's mouths or anything, they might have thought that the Ronald Reagan joke might be too obscure for the people of our generation. Let's throw in a George Bush joke.
I call bullshit, because if it was going to be obscure for our generation, or for the younger generation, then why are they even... first of all, the younger generation, probably not a lot of them going to see this movie. It's a really hard R. And
They could have toned down quite a few scenes, and it would have been perfectly fine, in my opinion.
I mean, we know we're watching an alternate 1985. The whole movie is 1985, and so I think it would have. I don't think it would have taken away to just. I forgot where I was going with this. I just derailed.
While we're on alternate 1985 and Nixon being president, oh my God, that nose prosthetic!
That was the that okay. Jillian, I was talking to Jillian after she saw this, and she's of one of the, you know, the demographic of people who had never read the book before and watched the movie, just going to watch the movie. And she thought that it actually worked to have such a comedic, obviously false Nixon there to kind of offset the really dark and gritty scenes. And I said, no, that's just really bad makeup. Play-Doh Nixon really just jarred me out of my immersion. When that happened,
I
Play-Doh Nixon was horrific, but I actually liked how they did their Kissinger. I was actually really impressed with that.
I'm not a big history buff, so I don't really know what Henry Kissinger looked like. So
why don't you explain that?
Pretty much like that.
The voice was really good.
Yeah.
Let me go back to that article for a minute. I found it.
Okay.
And you'll probably kill yourself after you hear this.
Let me just get up and get a drink of water. I'll be right back.
Talk amongst yourselves.
The studio said that we've looked at the script and we've identified three areas where you can cut. The comedian's funeral. You don't really need to do that. And they were like, Manhattan goes to Mars. Nothing happens there. And you don't need to interrogate Rorschach.
What?
Oh, I'm glad I missed that.
When that's the
that
entire...
That is so...
No.
That's like the movie. You don't need to make the movie. Nothing happens.
That's stupid.
Yeah, it's amazing what they just... They wanted it to focus on basically the murder mystery aspect of who killed the comedian. Which is like, but that's not what it's... Okay.
Well, even then, why cut out the comedian's funeral if the whole thing was who killed the comedian?
Right, you know? And I loved how they managed to do the flashbacks within the funeral. Except that it kind of took on this, you know, aspect of... Man, you remember that time he was a dick? Yeah! I remember this other time, too! Man, he really was a douche.
It was kind of like that.
Oh, going back to the funeral, did anyone else know that, notice Walter Kovacs holding that sign at the funeral?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Yes, I thought that was brilliant. I didn't realize it was him until, as soon as I left the theater, I was walking, and I was like, holy crap, that was Rorschach! And I was just really impressed by that.
Well, that's what's neat about the book. That's what's neat about the book. Yeah, he's in there. He's in there the whole time. He's the one who's walking through that pool of blood at the beginning.
He's the one narrating the story. He's the one. The story of Watchmen is basically Rorschach is telling the story. Even the parts that he's not in, he's the narrator. So it's you're looking at this entire thing, even though you're looking at it from other people's perspectives, it's still from Rorschach's perspective.
I kind of got to disagree on that one. I think he provides the strongest narrative force because you hear him read excerpts from his diary, but you still get to see very intimate moments into the other characters' lives. Because, like I said, it's a character study. It's not all about Rorschach. You get to see the whole, like, you pretty much get little bits of everybody's origin and why they do what they do, why they became superheroes in the first place. You got Rorschach, who decided since there's no God and God won't punish the guilty, he's going to have to do it. You got Dan Dreiberg, who's basically a legacy hero, and he's taking up, you know, he respected the original Night Owl. I was about to say Blue Beetle, but he respected the original Night Owl so much that, you know, he decided to take on the mantle. You got Silk Spectre, who was pushed into it by her mother. You know, the comedian who's just, I think, just doing it for shits and giggles, honestly. And Adrian, who's just trying to save the entire world. I'm missing somebody. Dr. Manhattan, I guess, just didn't have a choice. He never really chose to be a superhero. He just sort of did what everybody told him to do.
Mm-hmm. They also did a really good job with his... I'm really surprised they kept it in the movie exactly the way it is in the book with time skipping around.
Oh, I
disjointed
know.
Everything.
That was so beautifully done.
Now, speaking as... now, I'm going to take the perspective, and this is not what my perspective I'm going to take, but I'm for the purposes of this conversation, I'm going to take the perspective of somebody who's never read the book before, and I'm going to say that scene probably... Even though it was really awesome that they kept it faithful to the source material, probably was the most disjointed and unnerving and really confusing parts of the entire movie that would dissuade people who had never read the book from really liking it as much as they really should have.
Manhattan?
Yeah.
Yeah, what scene are you talking about?
The whole disjointed time when he's on Mars going through all his backstory and everything.
I gotta say, I took my mom, and, I mean, I talk about my mom a lot, but she does not read, she doesn't even know. She walked in not knowing what it was about.
She lives vicariously through your fandoms, I think.
I think she may. She really liked it, and she had no idea what was going on. She liked that part.
She had no, hey, this is kind of confusing and really disjointed, what's going on here moments?
No, well, I don't know specifically. She came back and asked me some stuff, but not about that part, because I think once she understood that it was like, here's this guy's past, present, and future, she was just like, oh, okay, well, it's going to be confusing, so it doesn't really matter. I'll just go along with it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not really telling you all that complex a story. It's just basically, I had this girlfriend. Here's how we grew apart. Here's how I hooked up with Laurie. You know, this is what happened to me, and I'm totally detached from my life. If you kind of focus on the bigger picture as opposed to the... But I mean, again, mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. If you're in the movie, you may not know that you need to pull back like that.
Yeah. Now, having read the book, I thought that was really awesome. But I'm just saying... I will go ahead and grant you that, because one of the things that they added way back at the beginning when you first meet Dr. Manhattan was a little conversation between John and Laurie about how he can see time in a way unlike everybody else. So they did kind of
it did have to be established.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got a gun in the third act. You got a gun shooting in the third act. It better be on the mantle in the first.
Yeah. So thinking back on that, I was like, okay, so it's probably not as confusing since they added that, and it really did work. So.
But I mean, she figured out that Rorschach was the redheaded guy, and she figured out that the comedian was Laurie's father. I don't know if it's just because she watches a lot of movies, and she just knew that that's what they were trying to tell you, but she was like, no, I guess that.
Laurie, I am your father. I'm sorry, we won't do that again.
Well, that brings up another point, is that one of the major things when I first read the book a year ago, but one of the major things for me was the whole Rorschach reveal. I will admit, it caught me by surprise, and I was like, wow, that's so cool that was that guy. And
you go back and you realize
that's him. He's in it from the very beginning. That's mm-hmm. how he found out about the murder, because he was walking right past the corpse and decided to investigate it. But how do you guys think, you know, again, for in your opinions, for if somebody who had never read the book before and saw the movie, how do you think they handled the Rorschach reveal, and how much impact do you think it had on that specific demographic?
Well, I can't answer that because I'm so colored by my having read the book again and again, but I will say that I did see it with a girl who had never, she doesn't read comics at all. And she never, ever, 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 ever read Watchmen before. I mean, she got through like maybe, her boyfriend tried to get her to read it before she saw the movie. And she says she got through about 4 pages of it. And she said that she wants to read books and not be so distracted by pictures. And okay, you know, fine, to each her own. But I'm going to kind of branch off into another topic here, because her reaction at the end, I got into a big fight with her because she was all like, afterwards, she goes, well, they shouldn't have killed the guy with the spotted face. I liked him. And I'm like, but that was his whole point. You know, never compromise, even in the face of Armageddon. And she's like, well, they just could have talked him out of it. And I'm like,
no.
I know.
Talk
I know.
Rorschach.
I can't...
Good luck.
It's not so much, and now she's a little bit mad at me for, you know, nagging her about not liking comics, but my whole
she's
point
gonna
is that it
wasn't, you for doing so over the
thing.
Entire internet.
It was I know. Well, I'm not mentioning her name at least, so I'm leaving her name out of it, but it's not a whether or not, you know, you got the comic thing, it's the whole message, the whole morality tale was that, but I mentioned this over on No Scans Daily. And it turned into this big conversation about, well, did they have to kill Rorschach? I say, yeah, absolutely. Because everyone's like, well, they could have just mind wiped him. And I'm like, no, no, no. That's not what he would have wanted. His whole point was extreme vigilante justice because he didn't see the world taking care of evil. And so he decided to step up and do it. And to just neuter him would have undermined his entire philosophy. And
it would have been way cooler. Than the mercy killing.
If it had been played
that
like that, it actually could have been a really interesting way to take the character, because
it would have undermined him, though.
Well, I think you would have killed him anyway. You just would have killed his mind.
Well, somebody yeah. mentioned that.
You say that like Alan Moore doesn't undermine everyone's character anyway.
That's fine. But somebody, the user Feline Phoenix, brought up in a lot of ways it was a mercy killing. And I hadn't thought of it that way before. That's and I think that Rorschach had realized that his mission to punish evil at whatever cost would never, ever be the same again. He knew that no matter what he did, Adrian's plan had forever compromised his worldview. And I think that Rorschach realized that on a purely logical level, Adrian may have had a point. It just kind of cracked Rorschach's, you know, his worldview completely in half, and he refused to accept it. And if he hadn't been killed, I think he definitely would have wanted to have been killed. And in fact, that's why he was the one begging. Who was asking Manhattan to do.
Yeah.
And
I mean, he realized it. I mean, before anybody else probably would have, like, what are you? Anybody else would have been, what are you doing out here, John? You can't stop me. He was like, okay, what's one more body? Go ahead and do it. See, he realized because... right as soon as he was walking out, even before John showed up outside, he knew. There was no way they were going to be able to let him live. Because
the whole point of Rorschach is no compromises. He mm-hmm. has this very specific value system in place, and it has to stay there no matter what the cost. And so I think it might have been a mercy killing.
Well, the one time he did compromise, it bit him in the ass. I mean, remember when he let the whole illegal drug thing with Moloch go? What happened then?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it bit him in the ass. Never again.
It kind of goes back to the, is he Kovacs pretending to be Rorschach's or Rorschach pretending to be Kovacs?
They're all pretending to be blood. They're all dreaming that they're butterflies.
Well, he didn't
turns
really...
out they're both Tyler Durden.
He really didn't, like, freak out and fully develop his Rorschach persona until that little girl was murdered. And he just had this epiphany of, like, God doesn't take care of us. God is dead. Nobody cares. You know, God is watching us, and he doesn't give a crap, so I'm going to have to do it.
How do you guys think that was handled?
I think that was handled really, really well. Obviously, they changed a couple of tiny little details in what he did with, you know, the little girl's murder and everything, but I guess it kind of lacked the emotional weight that it had in the book, but like I said, I mean, you know, you had to cut something somewhere. Well, you didn't really feel Rorschach like you did, like you felt it in the book, where you sort of watched his last shred of hope of humanity.
Disagree. I respectfully disagree. You see him trembling with rage, like you see him trying to decide whether or not he's going to do it. You don't see his face, you don't hear anything but heavy breathing, but you see him trembling. You see more emotion out of him in that one scene than you do... for the rest of the movie, with the exception, obviously, of his last scene. So, they handled that pretty damn well, in my opinion.
They may have handled the emotion well, but obviously because of the fact that it's a different medium, you couldn't get as inside of his head as you do in the book, and you know, really get into his motives. With the movie, you're left guessing as to his motives, and you figure it was just like this one thing that set him off, but if you read the book, it's like his whole life, it's sort of been proven that, you know, nobody cares, nobody's going to watch out for the little guy. All these little things, sort of like these little dominoes, fell over and culminated in his becoming Rorschach.
Well, the thing that's really interesting is that even, you know, this theme of God doesn't intervene and being afraid that, you know, there is no justice in that sense, Manhattan kind of echoes that because they keep calling him on this whole thing of like, you just watched this woman cut me in the face. You just watched me shoot her. Why didn't you stop me? You could have done it. And so when you have this God on earth, he doesn't do anything.
Exactly. I think that's sort of like just sort of reinforced Rorschach's whole point is that they're calling Manhattan God. You know, God exists and he's American is one of the more famous lines describing Dr. Manhattan. So you see this impassive, uncaring, you know, no ties to humanity except Lori, and then, you know what happens when she leaves, then he really cuts himself off. So there's just this underlying message of, you know, an uncaring God, you know, watching over the world and just letting humanity sink into this cesspool. And that's really, really downer, but it's just Rorschach's viewpoint. It's not everybody else's.
That one thing, now, granted, once again, this is, I am colored by the fact that I've already read the book and I've read all of the history and everything, but I think the line that they put in the movie, to kind of encompass everything, is that God didn't make the world the way it is. We did.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing what I knew then, that really struck me a lot more than it probably would have had I not read the book. And I think it probably got the point across better than anything else could have, if, you know, with the way that they were doing it.
You know what I find interesting about Rorschach is he's all about, like, black and white, you know, this point of view, this one, you know, he's really tunnel vision. But for his persona, he picks something that's the epitome of ambiguity. The Rorschach blot, where when you look at it is, you know, you get all these different interpretations, but he himself is such a narrow focused character. I just think it's really interesting to think of, you know, why he would have done that.
Well, at the same time, he blurs the line between hero and villain. That's what I love about the book, is that he and Ozymandias kind of in reverse ways, you know, Ozymandias is this great, you know, golden child, kind of billionaire, Olympic quality athlete, but he does something that is just so hideous. And you get into this whole argument of, do the ends justify the means? But you have this, you know, how could somebody like that do something like this? And then you have Rorschach, who is this, you know, alternately this loathsome, terrifying, off-putting, but kind of noble person who does terrible, terrible things, but in the name of justice. And so they kind of are like these dual reverses of each other, and it's crazy and
awesome.
And awesome.
Well, for bringing that up, here's a good roundtable question. Was Adrian right?
No, I just can't get behind, was Adrian being right? I just, no. No, well, no amount of death on that scale can ever be justified.
Well, not so much was Adrian right, but was everybody else right to sort of keep his secret, I should say.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit stickier, really.
Well, there's also the argument of, since it was already done, you know,
35 minutes ago.
Can I just say that killed me that they changed that line?
Just that little one word. I know.
I was like,
from big triggers.
Poetry, exactly, but like, you took all the punch out of it. I was like, mm-hmm. They gave that to you on a silver platter and you just changed it for the hell of it? What was that?
Okay. I was okay with him changing the line to comic book villain from Republic serial villain. That was perfectly fine. Nobody knows what Republic serials are anymore. But I do agree with you in that it took out a lot of the simplicity and the, you know, like you said, the punch of the line. What I was more upset about was that they took out Adrian's whole triumphant moment of, I did it! They killed that. I really hope they film that and it's going to be in the director's cut, which is coming to theaters in July, by the way. Don't have an exact release date, but it is going to be in July, director's cut of Watchmen.
I also love the scene.
Oh, I'll have to go see that again.
Oh, yeah.
It may be related or not, I can't remember, but when Manhattan just basically says, you know, nothing ever ends, this isn't going to stick. I think someone in my journal described it as, Adrian looks like he just got told that Santa Claus isn't real.
Well, the whole nothing ever ends thing, you can apply that to, it's sort of like, you sort of have to enjoy the time that you have. I mean, you can sort of apply it to the Minutemen, where actually, you know what? No, I'm going to kind of disagree with Dr. Manhattan and say everything ends. Not that nothing ever ends. It's that everything does end and everything is fleeting, you know, whether it's the happiness that the Minutemen enjoyed back in the 1940s to, you know, those moments in humanity before the whole nuclear war crisis was going on in alternate 1985, to the fact that, well, do any of us here remotely think that Adrian's whole, like, you know, peace is going to last at all?
No, not
even,
at all.
Even if you do,
here's another argument that Lewis was making, and he was pissed about it. And I really wanted to just take excerpts from his blog about it and kind of like splice them in here, but I'm going to give Kevin a break and not do that. Basically, his main arguing point, and I'm going to link to his blog about this, was that they changed the ending so that it wasn't as ambiguous. And I totally disagree with that. I think it absolutely was. As in the book, you know, you sort of close on you know, whether or not New Frontiersman is going to publish Rorschach's journal. Both the comic and the movie ended on that beat. Okay? So it's not like they went and they changed that aspect of the ending. But it doesn't feel... It didn't, to me, feel like it was a definite yes, they're going to find Rorschach's journal and destroy everything. But I don't think that Adrian's piece would have lasted at all. I read somewhere, and I wish to God I could remember where. I looked through all my links and I couldn't find it. But somebody mentioned that 9/11 showed that although everybody is going to rally around, you know, survivors of a great disaster or whatever like that, it's not going to last. I mean, even like mass, you know, mass murder, even that, it's so sad that it is this way, but, you know, until it's old news when the next mass murder comes along, you know? I mean, something, it can't unite. Tensions between the countries are so great, both here and in The Watchmen 1985. Even if there is, like, tentative peace and, you know, the war is stopped, I think it's only going to be postponed. You know, it only comes back worse. And nothing built out of something that's destroyed like that is going to last.
They also threw in a different element with making Manhattan the mm-hmm. weapon of destruction. When you drop an alien squid, that's kind of nobody's fault. But when you make it an American scientist / nuclear weapon, don't you think there's some resentment there?
Oh, are we going to get into that? Okay. I was
getting ready to mention the alien squid, yes.
I don't care that they changed it.
I don't care. But...
No, as like I said, before I saw the movie and I found out that they were getting rid of the squid, all I cared about was as long as you keep the results the same and as long as you keep Adrian's motives the same, that's all I give a shit about. You could blow people up with exploding cats for all I care.
As long as you make it believable.
Well, Dr. Manhattan's energy reactor spontaneously destroying cities across the globe makes exactly as much sense as a telepathic alien squid exploding in New York.
The problem with
the
squid had too much subtle backstory woven throughout the book that there would have just been no time to do it. There would have been no time.
Yes, because genetically
engineered alien squids are known for their subtlety.
Well, the origin of the squid was
the
very subtly
placed.
The artists,
the writers, and the dead psychic.
The whole conspiracy behind it. And that was what got the comedian killed in the first place, was he found out about the big conspiracy to create the squid.
I still couldn't even remember, as far as the movie went, how he was involved in the first place. I was just like, oh, okay. I'm sure it's the book.
Does it say? I'm gonna ask our listeners, and does it ever in the movie actually say how Eddie found out about Adrian's plan? Because that's kind of a big thing to jump over.
Yes. They glossed it over.
It does, but I don't remember how they phrased it.
At least they kept it. That's why he was killed. At least they kept that. But
guys.
Yeah.
They explained it. It was very, very glossed over, and it only really made sense if you had the backstory of reading the book. But they did keep that whole, like, almost word for word, the exchange between Eddie Blake and Moloch in his apartment. They kept that, even adding a few things, but they kept that original thing, that island, they got all that stuff there. Who would do that? They don't explain it any further.
Yeah, see, I want to know, like, how Eddie found out about it.
Like, what was his job? Like, what did he... Because, I mean, in the
book... Well, he was a government operative.
Right.
I guess he might have just...
How was he involved with Ozymandias that he had something to do with it, that he found out and was like, no, I can't.
You're going to make me go over like 2 feet and grab my copy of the book.
Oh, no, in the book he was on his way home. In the book he was, you know, on the way home from some mission and he saw this island and he said, ooh,
I can go investigate and
beat people's heads. And then he
So when you get, that's my point, is when you get rid of the island, you get rid of the squid, then how does Eddie find out about it? to get him, right. You know, to know all this stuff that ultimately leads to his death. I want to know where that was in the movie, because that's kind of a major thing to gloss over.
I'm sure somebody will come up with that, but yeah, I was kind of like, wait.
I really do hope so, because now I'm kind of lost. That's kind of a big thing to...
Gigantic sucking plot.
No, they dropped the squid. I hope they
drive a Mack truck through.
Oh, anyway.
Well, we've fanboyed enough over what we liked about the movie.
Well, no, we haven't. We totally haven't.
What parts just made you go, oh my god, I can't believe they did that?
It was
just
actually wait.
Yes, thank you. Yes. That's actually what I was getting to.
I lost
it in the theater. I just burst out laughing.
Yeah,
I felt really uncomfortable because there was an 11-year-old sitting next to me.
Okay. First off, this goes back to you know, a whole conversation we had a few episodes ago. Who would bring their 11-year-old kid to an R-rated movie, regardless of what it's about?
To be fair, she was very mature. She was talking to me before the movie started, and I swear to God, I thought she was 18. She looked 18. She talked like an adult.
Dana, this is not the first I've heard that phrase from you.
Usually those are boys. No, it just she spoke like an adult. That's what really kind of convinced me. You know what I mean? I mean, we were having like deep discussions about it.
Well,
and
in that case, yeah. No, I mean, if kids
don't
are,
worry,
are
Dana,
mature
Chris
enough,
Hansen will be in your kitchen soon enough.
If
did you bring him?
I'm surprised. Hey, he's got me on speed dial. Okay, with all the like 15-year-olds I've mistaken for 18-year-olds in my life. Three times in my life that's happened.
There was a sign at my theater at the ticket drop box, and you actually, it's a single drop box that you have to pass to get to any of the screening rooms. And it said, Watchmen is about superheroes, but it is not for children. It has graphic violence, graphic nudity. I mean, this being Alabama, I could tell the manager had this printed up on like his home computer and was like, do not blame me when you take your kids into this.
And I guarantee you that they still did. I bet you there were like a million parents who still did.
Sure,
it was
like,
a good idea though.
Mommy, what's that?
Yeah.
Giant blue radioactive Wang, honey.
Why is she hugging him? You know,
everybody's hugging.
Elbows don't move that way.
Oh, to paraphrase, you know, Will Wheaton, and yes, finally, I'm going to paraphrase Will Wheaton. We are, all of us, living in the shadow of Manhattan's junk.
I like to call it Lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
Adam, you okay there?
I'll be fine.
That wasn't that funny. And I think I ripped it off.
So you ripped off Lower Manhattan.
I think Adam just realized that, hey, we're talking about a penis.
Carmen San Diego.
Okay, I'm fine.
Adam, do we have to have the talk with you?
Shut up, Kevin.
You need an inhaler.
When a night owl and a specter love each other very much.
The freaking flamethrower. I mean,
oh, that
honest.
Hey.
That was in the book.
The flamethrower was canon. It was cheesy, but it was cheesy in the book.
Just because it's in canon doesn't make it a good idea.
I know, it was cheesy in the book too,
but that long. And I'm really pissed off. I'm really pissed off that they didn't use Billie Holiday. It's on the soundtrack, but
it's in the credits.
I can't find it. Well, I didn't.
It's in the end credits.
But they kept it in that scene. That was like the whole, like, that was, I mean, it's playing throughout the entire, in the, I'm just, you know what, I'm
actually not, granted there, it's not playing while they're having sex in the book either. It's playing while they're rescuing people from the burning building.
Well, they kind of, I don't know,
granted,
maybe could have set it on repeat.
Yeah,
I was relieved that they kind of shortened up the scene with the fire, because it wasn't like Laurie making coffee or something for people.
Oh yeah, she was in the ship.
Yeah, we really didn't need to see, you know, 5 minutes of her saying, "Okay, who wants a double mocha? Okay, a decaf? No, we don't have that. Come on."
I was like, that was
super
cheesy.
Coffee.
But what I really did think that they also could have made you know, one, they could have made the sex scene shorter, but they also, the gang mugging in the alley, they really could have toned that down. And it would have been perfectly fine, because that was way over the top for Dan.
I loved it, because you get to see them actually, well, first of all, you get to see Lori kicking ass, and you didn't get to see
but you can. No, you can. But you can show them kicking ass without having them killing at least two people. And isn't the whole thing about, hey, Rorschach
elder.
And, you know, ooh. Rorschach and Dr. Manhattan, they kill people. Isn't that like, you shouldn't do that. But, you know, and Eddie Blake, you just killed somebody. But then having
more to the
Lori
point, well...
snap someone's neck and then shiv somebody in the neck. I mean, I can forgive the bone breaking. I can forgive all the bones and the blood squirting out and the exposed whatever that is. but then she goes and snaps one person's neck and...
it worked for Wonder Woman. Not very
well,
but...
But I just think that they could have left out and it would have been just fine.
Well, they're grim and gritty, Kevin. That's what sells.
Well, at least
grim,
they
left
grim
dark
pirate
comics. Yeah,
I liked
how
they at least tried to work in the whole like sexual tension, you know, that whole thing with the cutting back and forth between, you know, what they were saying in Manhattan's interview and the whole like. I liked how they tried to keep that. Didn't work really well, but
I liked how they had the Night Owl and Rorschach shaking hands and then looking at each other like, does this mean we're gay? Moment.
Possibly homosexual? Must remember to investigate further.
Yes.
But not in a gay way.
No, they left that in the movie, and I thought that was probably one of the funnier parts of the books, is like, they have this whole man-love thing, and they're like,
wait a minute, it's the
80s. You know, it's like Bill and Ted hugging and then going, fag.
oh my god, speaking of
Bill and Ted
gaiety, did you see on Adrian's computer when Night Owl was messing around with it and it had a folder titled Boys?
No, but I did see that in the MTV did this whole list of little Easter eggs that you might have missed in Watchmen. And I'm gonna link to that because it makes mention of that. I also really liked the whole like
died.
I know.
Well, Ozymandias pairs himself a lot after Alexander the Great, and he was.
Oh, everybody back then was a, you know, sodomite. Everybody. Hercules.
That's how the Roman Armin stayed, you know, in shape.
I started thinking, like, how bad did computer porn suck in 1985?
Adam, would you care to demonstrate?
Wait. 10, go to, boy love, execute. Yeah, I don't know. I can't speak basic anymore.
Is it not binary? I mean, like, what was it?
Adam, go pull up the Wayback Machine.
1111111111.
Come on, Adam. Go ahead. Go look
at
gay porn on the internet.
Really, Ozymandias can't have more than a 56K modem, so it can't be that many pictures in there. I mean,
well, you
only
never
so
know. I mean, it's got that. Maybe, hey, you know, they made a lot of technological advances in the ultimate.
They've got electric flying cars. Okay,
yeah,
I'm sure
they
have.
No. This is 1985. They don't have cable internet yet. I'm decreeing this.
You don't know that. Manhattan created, you know, power for everything.
Someone go super up Alan Moore and ask him.
All right.
Well, after some of the things he's written, I don't want to know what his idea of Ozymandias' porn is.
Let's do a quick tiny roundtable. What was one of the really nitpicky things? Totally inconsequential, but just really bugged you throughout the movie.
If you're not going to have the genetic engineering, don't have the genetically engineered tiger cat with long ears. I mean, come on.
Cleo.
I triggered it 35 minutes ago. Oh my
Kevin.
God. Never get over that.
Music.
I gotta say.
And,
oh.
No, let me get into this. All let right. me get into this. All and right. and Cleo, I kind of interrupted you when you were talking about this before, but
can I say mine? It's two words.
All right.
Let me do mine. It's two words. Ozymandias' accent. Okay, now you can get to your thing.
Someone explain that to me. Someone
I saw, in your journal that was actually explained.
Now, I don't know that this makes it good, but it was, I had forgotten tell me if you remember this. Were his parents German in the book?
Let me pull up my copy.
Maybe former Nazis? I don't remember.
Hold on, let me go back to his backstory when he's...
To a Matthew Good interview where he said that
what
he
did I just do with my comic?
He was trying to do like a more polished American accent when he was talking to public figures like Lee Iacocca, you know, whatever that was about. But when he would be talking to Dan, he would slip more into German. Like he had this ambiguity of like...
The changing accent didn't bother me. The fact that he was well-nigh incomprehensible bothered me. I kept wanting subtitles.
I couldn't figure understood out that it was German. I thought it was some weird British kind of thing.
Actually,
like...
it kept shifting between British and German, yeah. And it never really locked down to one. But I got what they were doing is, like, he's more relaxed when he's talking to Dan or Rorschach, and then when he's got his public face, he's like, I'm just as American as any of all of you lot. What? I'm trying to find, because I think he may have talked about it during his, do you like this wine? It is poison flavored speech, but I'm
actually on that page right now, and he's talking about his history. Although to uncover the reasons for my current elation, one need not delve quite so deeply into antiquity. A mere 40 years will suffice, back to my childhood. My parents reached America the year I was born, 1939. At no point do they mention whether they're German, they don't mention his background.
Apparently Matthew okay. Good decided then that he was German and came from Nazi parents. I think this is where it must have come from, but that's what, I'll find you the interview that somebody linked to me, but yeah.
I mean, well, he's blonde and he has blue eyes, I'm just saying. Megalomaniac.
1939.
I'm sure you could draw an obvious kind of Nazi parallel, but it, like, you know, it's open to interpretation, like a lot of the other really good things about the book and movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I love about it, is that everybody can read. I mean, the thing's 20 years old, people are still talking about its themes and its morals and the whole minutiae of its characters, and I probably butchered that word, but, you know, all these little details, there's so much in it. That's why I love it so much.
I was talking to Jillian. Actually, you know, that's going back to the Jillian had never read the book before, and she was like, we're talking, and we each got totally different things from the movie. What she got from the movie, this is what she said, the theme that she got from the movie was that nothing really matters, everything's a big joke anyway. And I'm like, well, that's one of the aspects. It's not it's not the driving force, but it's one of the underlying themes. Yes, and
it's the comedians. That's his thing. But so she identified. So she identified with Eddie Blake, and that kind of troubles me a little bit.
That's the major thing that she pulled from all that, is that nothing matters. It's all a big joke anyway. And we got into this whole conversation, actually, in a minor argument at one point. where, you know, it's so much more than that all at the same time. Like, the whole duality between the idea of good and evil, the whole Cold War that America was going through at the time, and everybody's fear of nuclear holocaust anyway, and how that really influenced everybody's decision for everything. And it just all went into this whole big thing all at the same time. And it's really difficult to just sit there and pick out, that was the theme. That was what this entire thing was trying to teach me. That's what it was right there.
Well, it's sort of like, it depends on which character you identify with. Everybody had different viewpoints, and you know, it's gonna, you know, is gonna resonate with somebody, and that's the whole point of Watchmen, is it's not definitively about anything except for what you take out of it. Hey, much like a Rorschach blot. There's no meaning except for what we ascribe to it, is what Walter says. There's no meaning except what we ascribe to it.
Exactly.
In conclusion, then, yeah. Alan Moore, fucking genius.
Yes.
Kind of scary.
Very
scary.
Going back
to what I was saying about the music, they had a pretty decent orchestral score throughout the majority of it, and it was... interposed with period music at the time. You had Bob Dylan with the whole genius opening credit sequence that was absolutely wonderful. And the only other piece of real world music that I liked in there was Hendrix's All Along the Watchtowers, because
they
one,
had to put that right there because that's where it was.
That one, that and that very specific and that very specific line right there, two riders were approaching, and
well, they were
plus,
technically
I mean, how,
walking, I guess.
But well, at that point they were flying, but and also yes, it's really badass to see a flying airship cruising in at a cliff face with Hard Rock going in the background. That was, I was rocking out at that point. Even, you know,
well,
you,
Hendrix
go,
rules.
You go on and on. You go on and on about the meaning of this, the meaning of that. I was just rocking out.
I bet you Bob Dylan even thought that Jimmy's version of All Along the Watchtower was better than his. I bet
probably
you.
Probably, because Neil Diamond has said that UB40's version of Red Run Wine was way better than his version. So it's not unheard of. I'm just saying, the point is, it's not unheard of for you know, a recording artist to say that a cover is better than their original recording.
I have definitely heard Lou Reed say that Duran Duran's cover of Perfect Day was way better than his.
And I think Johnny Cash said, or Nine Inch Nails said, Johnny Cash's version of Hurt was...
Johnny Cash can make anything sound awesomer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
just as a
yes,
side note,
can.
have you heard the Prince version of All Along the Watchtower?
No, and I kind of don't want to now.
He did
well,
it at the
I...
Super Bowl of all places, and it's...
Oh,
it's,
yes, yes. It was actually pretty... It was pretty
really
neat.
Good. And he went into Foo Fighters.
Yeah, he went into Foo Fighters, like, right after that first verse.
Prince singing
the
Foo Fighters?
Yeah.
I'm so glad I don't watch football.
No, it was one of the best Super Bowl halftime shows I had ever seen was the Prince one, actually, because
you're
going to
make me YouTube
really
this after the show is done.
I'll send you
You
the
need
file.
To see it.
I have it.
Oh, God.
She has four separate audio files into four separate musics. I know because I downloaded them the moment she posted them.
I have it MP3. I have it burned as an MP3.
All right.
Yeah.
Just email it to me or something.
It was pretty awesome. But anyway, but the other parts... They had, you know, Hallelujah playing during the sex scene. The biggest nitpick I had was during the funeral, they had The Sound of Silence, which, that would have been just fine if they kept it at the, you know, the peaceful opening part, but then they started rocking out where you're trying to, you're like, this is so sad and so tranquil and everything, and then, you know, the drums kick in and
If they had ended it after that first time they sang The Sound of Silence and then they just fade out, that would have been great.
Or just looped the soft part, and that would have been just fine. But then I get where they were going. All the music, every single one of the pieces of music that they chose, it was all appropriate in one way or another. They could have done it better.
It's like it was exactly appropriate, but was it what you actually wanted to hear in terms of music at that point?
Yeah, I mean, they could have used one of the later covers of Hallelujah, which was a lot more sexual in theme than the one that they used, which is a lot more religious in theme. And that would have worked a lot better. I'm thinking, and this is just complete speculation at this point, did they pick that one original version just because the guy kind of sounded like Barry White?
The one version of Hallelujah that I actually have is by Rufus Wainwright, and I think it actually would have been a better choice, might have been worse. It just depends on your.
Wasn't that one
taste.
Of the more sexual versions anyway?
Maybe
I
it can
so.
Be interpreted that way. It has a lot of piano and all that good stuff.
They really seem to be going with new music that could have existed in that world 1985 or prior. So I think they, by their own rules, could not have used a cover. Recorded after 1985.
This from the same movie that put My Chemical Romance ruining Desolation Row at the end.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, is that the trailers that used the Smashing Pumpkins song and then the one that used the Muse song were so great.
That
and
was Muse? I've been dying to figure out what the hell that was.
Take a bow. I'll send
take
it to you.
No, I'll obtain it legally somewhere.
Legally, yes, legally. Yeah, I mean, those two trailers were so amazing, and then you get to the movie, and it's like, Hallelujah? Really?
What?
Okay.
I really loved that Smashing Pumpkins song in the trailer. I had I had the Batman and Robin soundtrack that it was on, and because at the very end of it, and I've had that for the longest time when I ripped it to my iTunes, and I put it on my iPod, and I just could not stop listening to it for, like, the longest time.
Well, they actually wrote that song, The End is the Beginning of the is the End,
yeah.
Because they knew they were going to be doing it for Batman, so they used Batman as, you know, the original 40s detective Batman as their influence. Like, this is what's going on in the mind of a superhero at that point. And then they did a rockier version, The Beginning is the End of the, is the Beginning, with slightly different lyrics too, which
well, that was the single, that's the one that got released, and
then
they
didn't, that got played on
yeah,
the radio.
They didn't use The Beginning is the End is the Beginning until just this trailer, and I the first time I saw that trailer I was just like, I have got to see this movie.
Yeah.
That was probably the best trailer ever.
I gotta tell you, when I got out of that theater though, I saw it on I saw it the Monday before it came out, actually. We scored some free passes. And,
which you will not shut up about.
Yeah, I know. Ha ha ha. I'm better than you are. But no,
little
I
Miss
I
Schadenfreude.
Literally, like pinned to the seat during the credit, and I was sitting there with my mouth hanging open, making like, you know, D colon face. I guess you can't. you can't just
gaping
say an emoticon.
Fish
damn it.
Yeah.
Gaping but, fish face.
Gaping fish face, and I'm sitting there, like. I tried to stand up, and I swear to God, I know I'm given to, like, bouts of extreme hyperbole, but I have witnesses. I had Carl feel my knees. They were shaking. I've never been that floored by a movie before. It was just, I mean, I couldn't even talk in any words afterwards other than, Watchmen, 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 Watchmen.
Yes, and we have Twitter and, Live Journal post to this event.
I know.
Yeah.
It was so good, though. I loved it.
Yeah, the opening credit sequence, as has been said, is probably the best thing to come out of that movie. And, I mean, in addition to all the other awesome things, and all of the negative reviews that I have read have gone on and begrudgingly admitted that, okay, the opening credit sequence, absolutely genius.
Mm-hmm.
The company that made them actually put them online and then mm-hmm. yanked them back down. And I can't figure out if it's because everybody linked to it and their servers got hammered, or if because Warner Brothers called them up and said, you guys, that's the best part of the movie. You got to take it down.
Yeah, that,
like,
it could be one, it could be the other.
If all the reviews say this, they'll think they can see it and then not go see the movie. Take it down.
No, I don't think they're
yeah.
going to be that petty, are they? Well, never mind.
But one
it
of the negative
Warner
reviews...
Brothers, they are known for being kind of pettyish.
You
one
think?
Of the One of the negative reviews I had read, actually, was in Newsweek a couple weeks ago. Or was it last week? It was from somebody who was a fan of the comic book who thought that the movie was too faithful and thus too restrictive, and it the feeling of restriction in how things were handled kind of hurt the movie. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
You can't please anybody, honestly. If it was... how do you even complain about something being too faithful? How
first
is that even a complaint? I don't... I can't grok that.
The second Harry Potter movie, they were too faithful. It's like they had every single time the kids went to lunch, and it was like, Jesus Christ, move it along. Oh my God, are you kidding me?
I'm still better they didn't put Peeves in the Harry Potter movies. Don't get me started.
I only have one complaint with the third movie, and that was actually the best adaptation to that date. I have one major complaint, but we're gonna save that for something else because I don't want to get too off topic. We've gone off topic enough.
No. Go ahead and do a Harry Potter special. I'll just sort of be somewhere else on that.
Why don't we do a Harry Potter special for what is it, June or July-ish?
It's gonna have to be after whenever. It's gonna have to be after June. Yeah, Cleo's sitting there. Dibs.
Yeah, no, I was gonna ask you, Cleo. You wanna come along to the?
Yeah, I'm gonna have to be on the Harry Potter one. I'm just.
Please skip me over.
Prince.
I can't stand that little brat. Just take me completely out of the show for that one.
All right, fine. We'll have Made a Fail without Dana.
That's perfectly fine. I'm not doing that one. I won't have anything to say, which might be a blessing to some of our listeners. Are we wrapping up, do you think? Have we fanboyed and fangirled enough?
Does anybody have anything else they want to touch upon? Any other themes? Anything else they want to talk about it? I've kind of exhausted all my things mm-hmm. that I was saving up for this.
I'm out of material.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Because it's like, if you can think of something, we can all go on about it for 15 minutes.
I know.
Yeah, which is awesome, but...
I'm tapped out. Oh, was it good for you guys, too?
I'm like two planes in a forest.
Let me find a cigarette. Where's the lighter on this podcast? That was a Watchmen joke! Get it! Nobody loves me.
I got it.
No, I'm talking about... No, only Adam got the joke I said, but that's I'm not going to call attention to it.
Are you going to play Hallelujah under this part?
Oh, God. Well, now that you mention it.
I wasn't planning on it, but we've alienated... I don't think we've alienated our listeners long enough.
Have patience. It's coming.
But pish.
Dana, shut up.
Okay. Do you want to do fan mail? We got a few of them.
We have a few? Okay.
You have 937 messages, all of which are marked urgent.
Let me read one from, I'm going to mispronounce your last name, I'm so sorry, Joanne Lau. Oh, don't give me this crap, Yahoo. All of a sudden it won't let me read it. Come on.
Cough, Gmail, cough.
Oh, whatever. Okay. After semi-stalking you both for at least a couple of months now on Twitter, I guess I should send fan mail instead of bugging you with caps lock messages that include bad spelling of names. No, keep doing that. I love that. Tell Devin to speak more. If he doesn't, I will stick to my earlier belief that Kevin is actually a nom de plume for Dana and Kevin combined. Devin, prove me wrong. Speaking of co-host guest type people, the masses, me, demand more Tessa and Adam. I don't care
yes.
what that other dude thinks of Adam. I think he's funny. So there. Yeah, so there, Noel.
Adam, you've got a fan.
Hey!
Hooray!
Hey, thank you very much.
Hey,
that brings
female
you total
fan.
Up to one.
No, but he's got a fan girl.
Ooh, go Adam.
This is unprecedented.
This is a new experience for me, so please
A girl likes you. Hold on, she keeps going. I, as many other people, initially found you through Clea Linda, and when you have her on next, you should totally make her talk about Secret Life of Dolls.
Oh,
I know it's a Watchmen episode, but come on, 5 minutes of Secret Life of Dolls, four?
She goes on to beg, yeah.
Yeah, as I said in Twitter, I think it would be cool if you, Kevin, talked about how musicals suddenly have become relevant again with Dr. Horrible, Hairspray, Mamma Mia, Sweeney Todd. And what comic books or games would draw the largest geek crowd of the cinema if it was made into a musical? Because this is the kind of thing that I think about. Fables the musical. No, strike that. With Biggie's lungs, it'd have to be an opera. Apart from that, keep up the good work. You're all really funny, especially when you argue. And I roll for diplomacy has become part of my vocabulary, Joe. Thank you. Because I'll never live that down. So, Cleo, maybe four... 2 minutes of Secret Life of Dolls?
My dolls are more popular than I am. They have a fan club.
Can you explain, like...
Which I am actually a member of, by the way.
Maybe explain what it is that you do with the shelf real quick. Just sort of promote it.
Okay, basically... I'm sorry, this is just so bizarre. I had some Lord of the Rings dolls back when the movies came out, like 12-inch Toy Biz, you know, $19 whatever figures. And I have an Anna Valerius doll from Van Helsing and had that for a while. And just one day made some, and this was like a couple of years ago, made some joke about them getting into an argument or something. And then about a year later, I said something else about it. And it randomly turned into this ongoing thing, and I added a couple of more. I added an Elizabeth Swan doll and a Lyra from the Golden Compass. And look over there, see who else is there. That's it so far. Oh, and an Edward Cullen action figure.
You know what you did? You bought a Growing Up Cullen version. I swear you did.
I
I stick by my earlier statement that you should include Captain Jack Sparrow. I think that'd be marvelous.
Hey, let's...
Honor.
Adam, you're a part of the community. Isn't there a rule about speculating and demanding
no
that
talking
certain...
about who should be on the shelf.
Yeah,
well,
you just broke the rule.
Second rule is don't talk about who should be on the shelf.
So, people who run the Secret Life of Dolls fan club on LiveJournal, his username is Skybreakseeker, and you should ban him immediately for breaking the rules.
Hey.
I don't think it doesn't count if it's off LiveJournal.
I couldn't help it. I was weak.
I'm mostly right. concerned about, you know, dog injection.
Actually, I didn't post it in the community, so, huh.
Like I said.
But, yeah, and I have a little stuffed polar bear who's my Yorick Burnison, and he will figure largely or smallly, or however that works, in the next week or so. But
this is how good the Secret Life of Dolls is. I don't give a shit about dolls, but what you do with them, you ascribe these beautiful personalities to them, and you made me, I mean, I'm cracking up, although I do think you really should have a different icon for Faramir 1 and Faramir 2, because it's really hard to keep track.
I just like the caps lock.
Oh, and how Edward speaks
I read
in
it for...
really tiny font. Cause he's so
I just
little.
Read it for the caps lock, honestly.
I don't know. It just suddenly got really, really popular is not the right word for it, but people just really got really into it all of a sudden, and it was just kind of like...
Cultish?
I just have people who are like, when are you going to post another one? Are you going to post another one today?
Do you get
about
all the
tomorrow.
People who are like, you should have them say this and this person say that? That would drive me crazy.
That's where the rule on the fan community came from, because I was like, look, I can't read this stuff, because if you say it, then I'm like, oh, I don't want to use that because it looks like I took it from you. So
that's why a lot of famous authors don't read fanfic. They can't legally.
Did you hear what happened with Marion Zimmer Bradley? This was kind of a famous case.
No.
A long time ago, but someone, a fan, I mean, if you look on her Wikipedia article, it's there. Some fan writer wrote something or other, I think sent it to her, and then argued that her novel was too close to the fanfic and, like, sued her, and so she was never able to publish that novel.
Dude.
That is why people will not read, you know, they'll say, look, I can't read your fanfic. Just on a legal level, I can't do it, because... You could theoretically come after me if you thought something I wrote later was similar, and I just have plausible deniability of I never saw it.
Yeah.
Which, when you're writing, like, basically doll fan fiction, no, it doesn't matter, but it takes all the fun out of it to be like, oh, shit.
Which brings it to the other huge main point. You do this for fun. The moment it stops being fun, you stop doing it.
Yeah.
Fans of this, do you really want this to stop?
Yeah,
you
don't
know,
burn
if
her
you
up.
Do, shut up.
Okay, fine. I'll keep my ideas to myself.
That's where they belong. Or just put them all in Trope Cavern.
So, ladies and gentlemen, Cleolinda is officially telling her fans to shut up.
You're putting words in her mouth as we speak, Mister.
Yes, I am.
Well, get those out of her mouth.
Well, that's
so dirty.
Idea to have a fan community, and I was like, you know, while you're there, that's a great place to go talk about it. You can say anything you want to over there, because I won't hear it. That's great. But yeah, I think I'm gonna host another one on Friday. I'm trying not to burn through the story too fast, because like, I'm actually talking to somebody at Entertainment Earth about this. I was like, because she had emailed me about something, and I was like, look, do you know anything about the NECA figures? When are they gonna put out another one? I have to know for this story. You know, am I going to get an Alice or a Bella anytime soon? Or am I going to have to tread water for 2 months? What am I going to do?
I think the icons that your fan group produce are really hysterical, though. I really love the one about, you know, he'll scrapbook in hell.
They're so much better than mine. They're so much better. But yeah.
Okay. Kevin, you want to read the life lessons from Made of Fail that we got this morning?
Life lessons from Made of Fail. Hello! The other day, I was out having a lovely dinner with my boyfriend when some guy, the owner of the restaurant I later found out, and a friend of my boy, came up to us and started ranting about Watchmen and Brand New Day. My boyfriend smiled, nodded. He knows nothing about comics. After a while, I got bored. So I looked up at the guy and told him that the problem with Brand New Day was that it was totally out of character for Spider-Man to make a deal with the devil. And then I went back to enjoying my Mugu Guy Pan. The guy sputtered a little and then went away. The fun part? Everything I know about American comics, I learned from listening to Made of Fail.
They're so screwed.
Thank you. I love your podcast. Smiley face. Sarah. P.S. Cleo Linda is awesome. Please have her as a guest again.
Okay!
What is it with our fandom? Okay, I think, Cleo, do you really want this podcast? Because I think they like you more than they like us, honestly.
It doesn't really say that. It does not really say
it
that.
It really says that, I swear, on my grandmother's grave.
I will forward this to you. I will screen cap this. See, screen caps or it didn't happen. I will screen cap this and send it to you. P.S.
Cleo
Linda is awesome. Please have her as a guest
our
again.
Our two males are screaming for you.
Yes.
To be fair, I don't care because you've given us like 90% of our listeners.
Yeah, granted, this is true, but... Do you want it? I mean, they're all here for you anyway.
Apparently.
We actually have... do we want to...
We've got one about Watchmen, but since we already went off like about it, let's read it next episode to fill up space. I mean, to you know, just sort of keep it.
Well, we can, but we also, you were the one who asked her to write it and send it in.
I did, but let's just make it like a call and response thing. We did Watchmen this episode, and here's what somebody else said about it. We'll do that next episode to fill up space.
All right, Brandy, we haven't forgotten you. All right, trust us on that. I'm just going to click save on this. No, save. Oh, God.
Did you delete the internet?
I deleted the internet.
You bastard.
You clogged the tubes?
Yes.
It's not like a truck. You can't just dump stuff on it.
Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, well, asking senators, is there anything they won't say?
Yes.
Awkward. Awkward silence.
Anyway, that I do believe that brings us to the end of the fan mail. We do have other fan mail that we have gotten. Guys,
we're saving it.
Written this. We're saving it for June. Especially the ones that are, you know, explicitly tagged. This is for the June episode, listener generated content, all of that.
Which we should mention again. We have the big honkin' anniversary spectacular coming up in June. We're requesting listener-generated content, and we're planning a really cool surprise for you guys if we can pull it off. All
right, so don't feel, you know, in any way awkward or nervous about sending us in stuff. Without you guys, we wouldn't continue doing this because this wouldn't be fun for us. So we just want to take this opportunity, the whole anniversary episode.
Is going to be basically a love letter to you guys.
Dana is going to pretend for one moment that the world does not revolve around her.
But just a moment.
So, look at the concession she's making for you guys. Anyway, Dana, where can they send us those emails or comments?
made_of_fail@yahoo.com.
Or you can comment on the show notes in our LiveJournal community at community.livejournal.com/thankyoudana made_of_fail_PC.
Leave it to me to always remember the slash.
Yes.
Thank you, Adam and Cleo, for coming on again, especially you, yes. Cleo. We love having you on because you generate 90% of our listeners.
I feel so terrible.
Why?
Dana,
what?
We love her because she is an awesome person who likes to be on our podcast.
Jeez, I can't just be silly.
No, you can't. Remember, you still haven't cleaned up from the last time that happened, okay?
Sorry. I'll get the mop.
Thanks. All right, well, I do believe this draws us to a close. This has been Made of Fail. Thank you all for listening. Have a good night.
Shadow.